Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and today I am pleased to welcome Joshua Eiler, who is the author of How Humans Learn, The Science and Stories Behind Effective College Teaching, new from West Virginia University Press. Josh, welcome.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
So if we could, why don't we start out, tell everybody a little bit about who you are and how you came to this particular book.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I am currently the director of the Center for Teaching Excellence and an adjunct associate professor of humanities here at Rice University. The teaching center started in 2012, and I came on board shortly thereafter to help start some of the programming. Before that, I was at George Mason University in Northern Virginia, where I was associate director of a similar center. So the book comes out of my work with these teaching and learning centers. Prior to moving into that field, I was had been approved for tenure as a medieval studies professor at a school in Georgia. When I first began working in teaching and learning centers, these teaching initiatives writ large, I was talking to a lot of faculty, observing a lot of faculty, doing a lot of reading about different teaching strategies in a whole host of disciplines. And what I discovered was that there's a lot of information about what works, and also a lot out there about how it works. So, there's a whole canon of evidence-based teaching practices and, a long list of handbooks that will help you implement those in the classroom. But those weren't addressing all of my questions. I had a lot of questions about why certain teaching strategies worked well and others didn't. And it was really trying to seek answers to that question that led me to this book and that led me to areas of research and disciplines that I didn't normally look at. Those like developmental psychology, cognitive neuroscience, biological anthropology, evolutionary biology, that often deal in significant ways with how people learn, but don't necessarily talk to each other very much about that question. And so my goal for the book in trying to answer this why question was to synthesize those areas and apply it to our practice as teachers.
So let's see if in the time we've got together we can't make a little bit of sense of all of that.
Sure.
And introduce folks to literature they may not be familiar with. I know a lot of the stuff in the sort of the physical and the developmental sciences I've not come across too terribly much. You organize the books in sort of five main chapters. Mm-hmm. That I sort of think of as the features of the learning process that you've homed in on: curiosity, sociality, emotion, authenticity, and failure. So if we can, why don't we simply sort of walk through those, maybe not so simply, walk through each of those in turn and maybe tell us a little bit about how and why you think each of them matters in perhaps sort of biological or evolutionary terms, and then sort of find your way into maybe talking about how in each of those we can use, if we start by talking about curiosity, right? What do we know about how curiosity affects how we learn, and then what can we as instructors do to actually implement that in the classroom? So let's talk a little bit about curiosity.
Sure, definitely. Good. And I do want to say that, as someone in the humanities, it may not appear at first blush to make sense that I would write a book about science. But it took me about 5 years to write the book. I spent a long time becoming familiar with these different areas, had colleagues here at Rice help me when I had questions. And so it was really important to me that that those researchers working in this field would find what I was saying credible. They didn't have to agree necessarily, but I did want them to find it credible. And curiosity is one of the prime examples of a concept that has been dealt with in great detail by many scientists from a variety of disciplines. And so navigating those waters, I think, in the first chapter serves as a kind of foundation for what I tried to do in the rest of the book. From a biological kind of standpoint, it becomes really clear if you look at the development of the human species that curiosity was an absolute building block from the very start for how we learn new things, how our brains process new information, and ultimately the evolution of our brains itself. It was a kind of a key factor in that. Now, the nature of the role it played is debated, but most people will agree that it had a kind of prime role in that. And so simply it's kind of genesis as this kind of intimately connected part of our learning process from the very beginning makes it a really important thing to be thinking about in our own teaching. But it's important that we, and I try to do this in each of the chapters, to move from the theory, the science, to practicality. And so I quickly transition from looking at the biology to looking at where we see curiosity most present in the world, and that is with young children. And we learned two things from watching the curiosity of young children. I tell a story in there about watching my daughter when she was a baby explore the world for the first time. And so one thing that we learned is that curiosity is an all-encompassing kind of visceral approach to the world. It is not just a cool thing to have going on. It's an absolute necessity. So it's kind of a driving force for the way children seek out information about the world. So you combine that with the fact that the other thing that we really learn about curiosity when we observe children is that the question, asking questions, the question becomes the unit of curiosity, the sort of mechanism by which children express this curiosity. You combine these two things together, and we really do start to learn a lot about the teaching and learning process. And, I could go on for probably hours, much too long for this podcast, about children's questions. But in a sense, then, after doing some of the research there, what I was most interested in was, okay, well, what happens to this? How can we, where does this curiosity go? How can we kind of tap back into it as a tool for student learning in our college courses? And so it's interesting to see some of the education researchers looking at children's curiosity, what happens to it when they enter the schooling system. And the sad spoiler alert about that is that some of it fades into the background as children learn what's expected of them, how to play the education game. So that when we meet them in college, they've had a whole schooling career of learning to do what is necessary to get the credentials to move to the next step to meet the standard rather than exercising an intellectual curiosity. So knowing that, then we have to, if we can use the scientific research to say, okay, well, let's put all this together then and try and reach back and sort of tap back into that curiosity, bring it to the surface again. Some key ways that we can do that is to really focus on that unit of curiosity again, that driver of children's curiosity, which is questions. A lot of the work on what we can do with curiosity in the classroom really comes back to how can we build courses and curricula around inquiry and questions. And so some of that can be really well-run discussions, really well-designed discussion questions. Some of it can be assignments and activities that help students to generate really good questions. I actually personally think, you know, one of the goals of a college education is to really get the tools to learn how to ask great questions. Some of it can be undergraduate research. Some of it can be constructivist teaching, where we're helping students to build the knowledge for themselves. But if we're really to use curiosity as a tool and to access what we know about human curiosity, we have to focus on the asking of questions and center on ways that we can help students build the skills to ask and answer questions.
Can you offer an example of an instructor who you've seen sort of doing that really well?
Sure. Yes. I use a couple examples in the book, but so. There's an instructor here at Rice named Dennis Houston who is really, he actually just retired last year, but is amazing at leading discussions. And he, I think, serves as a good example of what we know in terms of designing the best discussions, which is moving from closed-ended questions to open-ended questions. So closed-ended questions, what was the name of the guy who wore the red shirt on page 42, those kinds of questions, can be a good warm-up, but they quickly lead to roadblocks if you want an effective discussion. So moving to more open-ended questions, kinds of questions that students can bring multiple lenses, multiple modes of inquiry to that question. So he will ask really, really kind of broad, open, yet analytical questions about Shakespeare. I observed him teaching a King Lear court class session. And then he will kind of he will call on someone to respond, and then he will follow up with why, kind of pushing the student to dig deeper into the analysis of the text through these questions. So he's a really great example that I've seen.
So one of the things that we can all, I suspect, be doing a little bit better is looking for opportunities to try to undo some of the damage that some of our students encountered during their previous educational lives, and look for opportunities to foster that kind of that childlike curiosity, right? To tap into that, to make them genuinely engaged. In reading that chapter, I thought a lot about puzzles and about sort of creating puzzles for students. Absolutely. I thought a little bit about some of the work that's going on around gamification, mm-hmm. right? And that making learning akin to play in some ways.
Yes.
So the next sort of principle or sort of feature of learning that you highlight for us is sociality, which I think you've sort of given away some of there in talking about play, but you also talk about storytelling. You talk about sort of the social aspects of learning. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I'm particularly interested there in the implications for online learning and what that may tell us about what's likely to work well and what might work less well as we think about the increasing migration of courses to online environments.
Sure. Excellent. So if if curiosity is kind of what drives us as individuals to learn, I think it is also accurate to say then that in order to enhance that learning, we need other people. We are nothing if not social creatures. In fact, we're some of the most social beings on the planet. And so, the learning process, a lot of the research on this illustrates that the learning process, in order to be maximized, you need another person, at least one other person for this to make sense. And a lot of that comes back to our social natures. And so certainly we can learn things as individuals, but we don't learn them as deeply or as well unless we're learning them with and from other people. And so that's kind of the core of it, really looking at how our teaching and learning strategies and behaviors emerged from our social connections to other people. They're not just enhanced because of that, but they actually emerged from that. The connection then to social learning theories like Lev Vygotsky's zone of proximal development is one I really like, which is very simply says that for any given concept, each of us has a zone in which we can develop knowledge by ourselves, but eventually we hit a limit and need what he calls a knowledgeable other to help us move past that limit. And those zones are, you know, of different sizes for all of us, depending on the concept, the topic, etc. So how we learn is really tied to the question of who are we learning with? Is it just ourselves or is it other people? So that's kind of the basis of it. And then how we see that playing out in the classroom from everything from, again, discussions, but also to collaborative learning is something I spend a lot of time on in that chapter because, you know, one of the most vexing questions for teachers is how do we do group work well? How do we make it meaningful? How do we make it valuable? And I think the most instructive thing I learned from doing the research on this chapter is that we cannot do group work just for the sake of doing group work. And we have to design assignments that ask students to genuinely work as a team to develop knowledge, not to create assignments that allow them to divide and conquer. So if we have, and students, you know, they, in order to prioritize in terms of their time and other factors, will often do that with group assignments. They will say, okay, you take part A, I'll take part B, you take part C, we'll come back together for the presentation. Assignments like that don't actually utilize the sociality of learning. It's really just an individual assignment in disguise because everyone's doing their own thing and then they're combining at the end. So projects and assignments that instead cannot be completed unless people are working together to develop knowledge. Like I have something, I have a bit of information that no one else has, and we have to work together to kind of put those things together. Those are really important ways, I think, to be thinking about collaborative learning based on some of these models of sociality. Creating classrooms that are welcoming climates, focusing on social belonging, which is a really important mm-hmm. social psychological concept that's I would say being integrated with educational research over the last 5 to 10 years. You can talk more about that if you'd like, but to get to online and hybrid models of teaching and learning. One obstacle that fully online courses face is the screen and the distance. And so many researchers who sort of work in this at the intersection of effective online learning and teaching practices and the social dynamics of education have highlighted a concept they call social presence as being a predictor of success for students in online environments. And social presence simply means the degree to which students actually feel and believe that they are part of a community, that they are interacting socially with other people in the class. And in those courses where students experience less social presence, they tend to achieve at levels below what we would hope for them. The more attention instructors pay to cultivating social presence in their courses, the higher the levels of success is at least what the research is showing right now.
which would seem to be an argument in favor of finding space for synchronous live engagement with students online rather than constructing a course in entirely asynchronous. Yeah.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I think that is one of the, if you're looking at low-hanging fruit in terms of developing or cultivating social presence, that's one of the easiest things. Right. And, their institutions are trying to do that in a variety of ways. I think UT Austin has very large enrollment courses, something like 1,000 students, 30 students actually in the classroom. The rest are watching it via video and can kind of, electronically raise their hands and things like that. Others are experimenting with and having success with Google Hangouts and breakout rooms and things like that. But it does have to be synchronous, as you're saying.
Yeah. So something that, at least in my mind, is very much related is the emotional aspects of learning. Can you talk next a little bit about that?
Sure. Yes. This is probably the chapter that's nearest and dearest to me, because I think that, fundamentally teaching is driven by empathetic connections with our students and understanding them as fellow human beings in our classrooms. For a very long time, and still to this day, I would say that talking about our emotions or emotions in the classroom can create a little bit of a wall between us and our colleagues, because it's not an element that we usually talk about in terms of college teaching. And I think that stems from this very long history where emotion was seen as being entirely separate from cognitive processes and cognition. And it's only, last few decades that have really showed us in great detail how emotion and cognition work hand in hand, that primed that when we can prime students' emotions, that they are remembering information in more detail, they're developing better conceptual models. And so there's a real emotional underpinning to the cognitive work that we ask students to do. But the subject itself, the idea of emotion and teaching is quite big. It can be everything from, trying to find the emotional content in the material we're teaching. An example I use a lot is comparing two biology courses, both teaching about cancer, one just teaching it at a cellular level, and one weaving in stories of survivors. The idea of priming students' emotions to remember that material, I think, has real basis in the literature. But it doesn't have to be anything as necessarily dramatic as that. It can be the use of humor in the classroom. It can be helping students to see the joy of the subject matter. And really, I think one of the primary ways that great teachers utilize emotions in the classroom all the time, in fact, is just simply showing our enthusiasm about what we're teaching and sharing that with students. And it's often, it's often described as being contagious. And I think there's a good reason for that. So the emotional landscape in terms of education is really quite broad, I think.
And some of that is as simple as finding ways to communicate to students that you care about them. You care about their well-being. You care about their learning. You care about what's going on in their lives. And does that also have sort of demonstrable cognitive benefits other than just being a good person?
It does. And actually, I was surprised by how much is written about what they call pedagogical caring, caring about our students as learners. And I have a whole section on the chapter about this because it is such an important and emerging as a significant topic for education. And Nell Noddings is an educational philosopher who has written quite a lot about this, that students respond to teachers who are making it clear that they care about their learning. And so there are studies that show that are showing the degree to which students detecting that kind of caring center or caring pedagogy are learning more effectively in the classroom.
Yeah, which I think, I mean, among other things, I think there are political implications to this too, right? If you think about sort of what can sometimes be the narrow and I would argue uninformed national dialogue about what's going on in universities and in classrooms and concerns, right, that we're coddling students and all of that, what I think is silliness. Right. That demonstration of caring is not ancillary to the project of education. It is, in fact, essential to it.
Yes, that is absolutely right. And I think that this literature in particular, and I actually end by talking about trigger warnings because it is also a part of that national conversation. But that caring is not, as you said, ancillary. It is at the heart of what we do as teachers. And that literature can be used, and I hope will be used in the future, to push back on that narrative that we are coddling students, or that is somehow not that the notion that we might see students as people and care about their progress in our courses is not somehow anathema to education, but it plays a central role.
Which in a funny way feels to me like a perfect segue to talking about authenticity, to talking about ways in which another thing that is contested among some of our colleagues, the notion that what we do in the classroom might connect to the world outside the classroom.
Yes. And that word authenticity is kind of it's bandied about a lot. It means and can mean a lot of different things, I think. But the way I have specifically used it in the book is comes out of the research on what scientists have called cognitive authenticity or situated cognition. There are kind of two threads there. But both come back to the brain's ability to detect artificial versus authentic learning environments. So what seems real to the brain? And, you know, it's fundamentally true that our brains are very kind of ruthlessly pragmatic organs. If we're in a learning environment, it's not immediately clear that it's relevant or important in some way. I mean, our attentional resources, our cognitive resources, will quickly get allocated elsewhere, right? And so the work of that chapter then is to say, okay, well, what does real mean, and how can we make our courses and our activities look be applicable, be relevant, and really engage with the real work of our disciplines. And so, undergraduate research is a great example. How can we, but it's not the only example of helping students do the real work of the discipline. I think when we talk about undergraduate research, which is having, a lot of popularity across the country right now, and it's amazing, but it doesn't have to be as broad or as intensive as I think a lot of people assume when we talk about undergraduate research. It can be an activity that lasts a class session or a couple of class sessions that asks students to work with real data or primary sources in history or anything that's giving them the real experience of what scholars in the discipline are doing. That gets right to the heart of authenticity.
Is there any evidence that sort of one-off approach, right? You got, say, a more traditional kind of class, but there's going to be one applied or experiential or more active learning component during 1 week. Is there research that tells us whether there are likely to be carryover effects for other learning throughout the rest of that course?
That's a great question. I don't know of any studies that specifically attack that question.
Okay.
I do know that in general, the outcomes have shown a positive effect of assignments like that, undergraduate research writ large. But that would be interesting to take a look at, actually. And I think of this book, in other words, really as the beginning of a conversation. None of them are the sole answers. And I think there's a lot more work in exactly the areas that you're talking about to be done.
Yeah. So I interrupted you. You were talking about experiential learning.
Sure.
You say a little just... because there's good in experiential learning and there's bad experiential learning, right? Like group work, right? Good group work and bad group work.
That's exactly right. And again, this is another huge umbrella term, experiential learning. There's so much that fits under there. And you're right, it has to be carefully designed. It has to be, designed with a lot of these principles that we've been talking about. And so let's take service learning as an example, learning out in the community with others and for others. The most successful service learning modules have not just volunteering, it's actually implementing significant and rigorous intellectual work and assignments as part of not an addendum to, but in tandem with the service work and in-depth reflections on that work that come in at the end of the semester. So you can't just have students volunteering and expect them to be able to make the connections themselves to the work of the course or the overall relevance and significance of the volunteer work. There has to be intellectual components and scaffolding that gets them to that place.
And so the final big feature that you point to is you talk about the importance of failure in how it is that we have evolved to learn, and talk about a phrase that I love, the error climate in your classroom.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about those for us?
Sure, definitely. And this has been a topic that I think a lot of folks I've been talking to recently have latched onto, the notion of failure. And so, The way I discuss it in the chapter is to talk about the kind of failure, errors, mistakes that we might see students making or experiencing within a class session or within a class over time. I'm not talking about the giving students the ability or the leeway to fail entire courses or to experience failure on a life-altering scale,
right.
Because there's certainly some students who can afford to do that more than others, and that gets into socioeconomic and demographic information or components. So that's not the kind of failure I'm talking about, more like cognitive errors and mistakes, which our brains are making all the time. That's one thing the research is very clear on. We are kind of error machines. We're making them all the time because we're judging things based on what has happened before, not necessarily what may actually be happening. But our brains also have these mechanisms for detecting error and drawing cognitive resources to the errors. So it's really, I think moving forward, the future of education is really figuring out how we can create environments where students have opportunities to fail in low or no stakes settings so they can actually experience the learning process.
Yeah.
I mean, as scholars, we know that we don't walk into a lab or into the library and immediately find the earth-shattering revelations that we were seeking. It's a long process of trial and error and looping back around again through that process. And so, but we often have designed environments where we're asking exactly the opposite of students. We give them one shot on really high stakes kinds of assessments. So building in opportunities for them to actually utilize the failure components of the learning process, I think, is really essential. And you mentioned the error climate of our course is the tolerance of the instructor for student errors and mistakes, and the degree to which we have created courses that allow for those opportunities for failure, I think. And so this was a fascinating chapter to write. I mean, honestly, one of the things I loved about this book was it just, I was so interested in everything I was reading, the research I was reading, and the failure, the stuff on failure is probably at the top of that list, because it was certainly not the way I was trained as a graduate student to think about the positive elements of failure. Yeah. And it's not something that I initially was very conscious of as a teacher, but the research that's happening on it, it's pretty dramatic in terms of how it can help our students both academically and psychologically, and the way those two kind of interact with each other in the end, I think is really a valuable thing to be thinking about in education.
It, you know, it's funny because that failure to respect the value of failure is something that's reflected, I think, more broadly in some of our disciplines, right? In the social sciences, there is sort of an ongoing Sure. debate about the difficulty in getting journals to publish null results.
Right.
But that's right. That's super fascinating stuff, potentially,
yes, it is.
Right?
Right?
But you can't get it published, which dissuades us from doing it. If we don't think we're going to come up with this exciting new finding, then there are in some ways sort of selfish motivations for our own advancement to steer us away from things that we think might fail.
Right. I agree completely.
So in that vein, you talk a little bit about this in the book, and I'll confess up front, this gets onto one of my own personal hobby horses.
Sure.
Talk about the implications of all of this for grades.
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, the long story short about this is that most of what we have learned about the necessity of failure and errors and mistakes for the learning process really shows us that grades are antithetical to learning. It's feedback that enhances learning, not grades. Now, and I'll explain why in a second, but there is a way that we might see grades as a type of feedback, but most often grades are communicating the degree to which a student either does or does not live up to a standard. And that runs against our natural learning process, which demands that we make these mistakes. And so, and to learn from them in order to push forward. So an evaluative approach to learning then really kind of counters what we have learned about the natural process of learning. So, but the problem is that almost all of us teach in contexts at institutions where we have to give grades. There are some places that don't give grades, but most of the places where faculty work, they do give grades. And so how do we cultivate these environments for failure, for utilizing failure, if we have to ultimately give grades? And I think that's a very tough question to answer. I do think that two things that we can do are once we build these pedagogies into our repertoire, to talk to students a lot about the process, about why we have designed courses to allow them to, take intellectual risks and make mistakes. The other thing that we can try is alternative models of grading, like contract grading, specifications grading, portfolio grading. Ultimately, we still have to give a grade, but those models help, I think, to divest learning from grades. And so they really emphasize feedback, which again, giving feedback often without grades is the best way to help our students sort of advance along this learning process.
You're listening to the New Books Network. I am Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and we have been speaking with Josh Eiler, who is the author of How Humans Learn, The Science and Stories Behind Effective College Teaching from West Virginia University Press. And I think that if you are engaged in teaching college students, I think you should read this book, even if you have given lots of thought to your teaching. I think that there's a synthesis of information here that we don't run across in the other literature on pedagogy. And I know that I appreciate it in part because it's confirmed some things that I suspected. And we always enjoy those kinds of things. Yes. But also because it has opened me up to sort of thinking about learning in that sort of deeper kind of way, right? That's what's going on physiologically, what's going on biologically, what's going on emotionally, that I hadn't really, I think, given too terribly much thought to. And I am hoping that will bear fruit in future courses. So Josh, tell us what you are working on next, if you would.
Sure, definitely. I recently gave a talk on teaching as a creative endeavor, and that's, I think, a first step in a larger project. Not sure if it'll be a book yet, but on the creative side of teaching, how teaching is also an art, and there is a lot of creative work and creative energy that goes into teaching, in addition to knowing these principles of science as well. So kind of the other side of the teaching coin.
Excellent. That was Josh Eiler, author of How Humans Learn, The Science and Stories Behind Effective College Teaching. You have been listening to the New Books Network. Thank you, Josh, for your time today.
Thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate it.